It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Corn is a staple in Iowa farm fields. Sweet corn is a staple on Iowa dinner tables. And the word corn has an interesting history all its own. Our English language expert, Patricia O'Connor, is here today to tell us about the name of our flagship crop. Hello, Patricia.
Hi, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
My pleasure.
Now, this word corn, it really is an unusual word.
Yes.
Give us a little bit of the history.
Well, it didn't start out meaning anything edible. The word started out meaning a grain or a small grain in the sense of a small particle, small hard particle of something, as of sand or salt. And only later did it come to be referred to as a seed or a piece of grain, as of, for instance, wheat, barley, oats, rye, that sort of thing. So to the Anglo-Saxons, the word corn simply meant grain in general, any grain. And by the way, this is where we get terms like barley corn, peppercorn. That meant a small grain of barley or a small grain of pepper. The peppercorn was the little round seed of the pepper plant. So it wasn't until the 1600s that the word corn was applied to the crop grown in the Western Hemisphere, the New World, called maize. This was grown in the Americas, and it was an unfamiliar grain to the early Americans. So at first they called it Indian corn. Now in those days, the term Indian was used disparagingly to mean substitute or pretend. So to the settlers, remember, corn meant any grain in general. So they referred to maize as Indian corn or Indian grain because to them it was a substitute grain or the Indian's version of grain. So consequently, in phrases like Indian bread, Indian cakes, Indian flour, and Indian pudding, the adjective there meant that the dish was made of ground maize, cornmeal, instead of what they thought of as real flour. So eventually, the early Americans became so accustomed to this new grain, Indian corn, that they started calling it simply corn for short. Now that's how in the colonies, corn came to mean specifically what we think of as corn today, while the British continued to think of the word corn as meaning any kind of grain.
So there was a real split at that point between American
Yes.
English and British English.
Yes. In fact, if you've read any 19th century British fiction, you may have read references to the corn laws in Britain. Now, these were about grain crops. A cornfield to them meant a field of grain. So they weren't talking about our kind of corn. And today, many speakers in Britain use the word corn in a local sense to mean whatever kind of cereal crop is being grown in a particular district. So in most parts of England, corn means wheat. While in northern Britain and Ireland, it means oats. Now, to add to the confusion, in parts of Germany, the word corn, spelled with a K, K-O-R-N, means rye. So there you go.
And so in Britain, if they're still not using corn the way that we use corn, but
no.
I'm sure they
use maize.
Some of our products get sold over there. Do they have corn
sure.
flakes?
I don't know. I suppose they do. I'm not sure if they call them corn flakes or maize flakes or what they call them. That wasn't a bit of research that I did, but there may be a British-born person out there listening who can answer that question.
So they would still use the term maize to mean corn?
Probably yes.
And in this country, we don't use maize for much of anything unless we're speaking
really,
in a historical sense.
We don't really use maize anymore. The word maize we adopted from the Spanish. I mean, we do have it. But it came originally from a word in the Taino language that was spoken by native Caribbean peoples at the time of Columbus. In fact, Columbus was the first person to record the word maíz in writing in Spanish in his diary about the year 1500. That's how the word entered Spanish, as maíz. Columbus recorded it as an Indian word.
Interesting. And so now, of course, we would only use that to describe one of the colors of the University of Michigan or or in Thanksgiving pageants at schools.
True. But in short, that's why to an American, ear of corn means a cob of maize. But to a farmer in Yorkshire, it might mean the head of a stalk of oats or wheat.
So the interesting thing is we came up with this word, or we started using this word in a new way, and then it became so incredibly important to us. I mean, not just in Iowa, although particularly in Iowa.
Oh yeah, but all over the country. In fact, it's not just the Western Hemisphere food anymore, which I want to get into a little bit later. But I mentioned ear of corn a moment ago, and when I was just after I graduated from Grinnell College back in the 70s, which is, of course, the dark ages for most of the people listening, I had a job detasseling corn. And as everybody out there knows, this involved walking through the rows, pulling off the tassels, which are the pollen-producing flowers, from the tops of the ears of corn. Now, this might bring up a question. Why do we say an ear of corn? Why an ear rather than a nose or a chin or a foot or a hand or whatever? Well, it turns out that English has two entirely separate and unrelated words spelled ear, E-A-R. There's the one we associate with corn, and there's the one that we hear with. Now, both words are very old. They've been around since Anglo-Saxon times, but they have entirely different prehistoric roots, and it's just by accident that we say ear of corn. Since Old English, the word ear has been used to mean a spike or a head of grain, the part of the cereal plant that contains the flower or ears. And this spiky agricultural word, ear, is descended from a very ancient Indo-European root that meant something like sharp or spiky or pointy. Now, this extremely old term came down through Proto-Germanic and finally landed into Old English, where it was recorded as the word ear around the year 800. And at about the same time, the other ear showed up in English, the one that we use for the organ of hearing. And it came from a different prehistoric root entirely. And it sounded something like aus or aus, and it meant the thing that we hear with. And this aus and aus is going to sound familiar to people who've studied Latin and Greek, because that's similar to words for hearing in Latin and Greek, like aural and auricular, things like that. But anyway, that word was originally spelled E-A-R-E, and eventually the E dropped off. But that's why we have two ears. So, and when we say ear of corn, we mean a spike or a sharp piece.
See, I always thought, well, it kind of looks like a donkey ear.
Donkey ear. No, not the donkey ear. It does look like a donkey ear, actually.
But that's just pure coincidence.
Yeah. And something else that your listeners may not be aware of is that English also has two entirely separate and distinct words spelled and pronounced corn, C-O-R-N. That's because the little horny growth you sometimes get on a sore toe is another word, corn, altogether completely unrelated from the corn that grows out in field.
Wow.
And again, there are two entirely different Indo-European roots behind these, one meaning a piece of grain or a hard particle of something, and the other meaning horn. Now, the word for the sore on the toe entered English in the 15th century, and it can be traced ultimately to the Latin word cornus, which means horn, as in cornet, You know, those sorts of words.
Huh.
So, yeah, we have two entirely different words, corn, two entirely different words, ear.
Now, we have another way that we use the word corn in the English language, the American English language, and that is when something is kind of silly or cheesy, we'll say it's corny. When
corny.
Did that develop?
Well, that's fairly recent. It was first recorded among jazz musicians in the 1930s, and they would call a style of playing corny if it was outmoded or worn out or countrified, rustic, old-fashioned, behind the times. Back then, something was corny or corn-fed or on the cob if it was trite or old-fashioned or you'd heard it before. And probably this comes from, say, imagine a rube fresh from the cornfields coming to the big city to make it in the jazz world and just not being quite hip to the jive, you know, that kind of thing. He was corny. He
All right, so it's another, it's kind of, you would use it,
it's
like you say,
slur.
Hick or hickish.
Yes, it's a slur on
although it
on
sounds
country.
So much nicer.
Yes.
At least.
But the terms corn-fed and on the cob fell out of use, but we still use corny. We still use it for an old joke, for instance, or that kind of thing.
Or any dad joke.
True.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment to talk more about corn and some of the phrases that surround corn in our language. Our guest today, Patricia O'Connor, she's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. You can also call with your questions for Pat or your pet peeves about the English language that you'd like to share. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. My master's gone away. Jimmy crack corn and I don't care. Jimmy crack.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With us this hour, Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com. And right now we're talking about corn. But if you have other English language questions you'd like to ask, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. So we've taken care of corny, Pat. How about some of the phrases that we like to use.
Well, actually, the song you just played, Jimmy Crack Corn, that's an interesting notion. Cracking corn. That song, by the way, goes back to the probably the 1840s. I think it was first recorded in 1846, Jimmy Crack Corn. But the notion here is that to make grits or hominy grits, you cracked corn, you dried the corn, and you put it on you either ran it between rollers, or you put it on a block, sometimes called a hominy block, and rolled a roller over it, or otherwise used some sort of pounding mechanism to crack it, to make grits or hominy grits each day. And the notion of the reason for the cracker in the phrase Georgia cracker, well, a Georgia cracker meant or still means a person who still cracks corn, cracks his own corn for hominy or for grits.
All right.
Yeah.
Who knew?
Yeah. Right.
Not what
corn
I thought at all.
Really, really a fount of information.
Absolutely. So how about knee high by the 4th of July? That doesn't actually have corn in the
yeah.
phrase, but it's one that we like to use. And it's not even remotely true anymore, at least not
no.
in Iowa.
No. Well, it used to be. I mean, there were times earlier in the 20th century before hybridizing and before advances in plant genetics in a lot of places where corn was grown, it was about knee high by the 4th of July. And if it wasn't, it hadn't gotten enough rain or something. Also, it was planted later. in early times. Even I think as late as the 50s, it might not have been planted till May. But nowadays, corn is planted earlier, and it's a different plant altogether, and it's much higher by the 4th of July. It might be, I don't know how high is it now. Some people out there could tell us.
Oh,
I'm in Florida right now.
Well over my head now.
Well over your head. So
yep.
There you go.
Although I was just in South Dakota last week, and their corn's a lot closer to knee high. So
Yeah. Well, what do you expect?
Right, exactly.
Right. Nebraska right. probably isn't as good either.
Are there any other? I'm sure not. Are there any other corn phrases we should hit before we get to the phones?
Well, somebody did ask me about one not too long ago. She wrote to me and said, "Have you ever heard of the phrase all corned up?" And she said that she thought it had to do with horses and horsemanship because her grandmother used the phrase, and she grew up around horses in England and Scotland. And she said that they would feed the horses oats, which they referred to as corn, to give the horses more nutrition. And the more grain they ate, the livelier they were, and sometimes headstrong and difficult to control. So a frisky horse was said to be all corned up if it was fed a diet that was mostly oats. Well, although I have found at least one early 20th century novel that referred to a frisky horse as all corned up, for the most part, all corned up means drunk or all liquored up. It's a reference to the grain that was used to make whiskey. Published references going back to the 1700s refer to the adjective corned as meaning drunk or intoxicated, tipsy. And drunks have been called all corned up since earlier than the term was used for horses.
Although I can't say that I've heard it recently.
No, it's a pretty corny, old corny phrase.
Well, we do have one corn-related question on the line at 866-780-9100. Bill in Blackhawk County. Hi, Bill.
Hello, Charity. How are you?
Good. What's your question today?
Well, I wondered about the origin of the phrase to corn, as in preserving beef with sodium, I think it's what, nitrite?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Anyway,
yeah,
corn product.
As in corned beef, yeah. That's a good question because for a long time I wondered what corn had to do with corned beef because there didn't seem to be any corn involved. But the truth is that this is one of those phrases that has to do with the other word corn, the one that's not the vegetable or the plant, the one that means a hard particle of something. And in early days, corn meant a small hard particle as of grain of sand or salt. And a corn of salt meant a little hard nugget of salt, a little pebble of salt. And that usage survives in the expression corned beef because it means beef that's cured in coarse grains of salt, little hunks of salt, like hard, kosher salt. You can get it in chunks. It's cured that way with coarse salt. So that's why it's called corned.
All right. And that's a very, very old name for it, I guess.
Very old. Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Bill, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah. People in very old Anglo-Saxon times talked about corning something as to preserve it. And things that were corned were preserved in salt, in hard, coarse salt.
Interesting. Well, if you have a question about corning or corn, you can give us a call at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. You can also call with your questions about other things about our language. Jeffrey's on the line from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Jeffrey.
Good morning, ladies. Splendid show. Straight away, I heard you, Patricia or Patty, I'm sorry.
Huh?
I lived in New York for a long time, and you spoke how the British accent, as it is now known in the Americas or in the world, came to be after the Revolutionary War. And I wrote my uncle here in Checktown a letter about it, And now I'm back here and I hear you again, and I can't explain exactly how that evolved.
Well, okay, this is the story. Before the colonies were established, all English-speaking people had a variety of accents according to where they lived in England. There was a language for Yorkshire. You know, there was a language among English-speaking people in Ireland and in Scotland and all over. And there was a separate accent for people who lived in what are called the home counties of England, which is around London. Now, after the when the colonies split off from England, the common language, the common accent spoken in the home counties, sounded much more like the American accent of today. It's been reconstructed as sounding like a pretty much like the Midwestern American accent, with a touch of maybe the Australian accent thrown in, and maybe a touch of the Irish accent thrown in. But at any rate, it sounded much more like an American speaking than a Brit. Around the 1780s, fashions in speech come and go. Around the 1780s in London, some people started speaking with a broad A in words like bath. They also started dropping the R's in words that ended in R or had an R before a vowel, like an R ending in one syllable and before a vowel, in words like father. The R became indistinct, so it was more like father. And there were other characteristics. For instance, in multi-syllable word like secretary, instead of pronouncing all four syllables, one of them would be elided, so it sounded more like secretary. There were several
cemetery.
Of these sorts
cemetery.
Of, yeah, right, secretary, husband, that's not a good example. But anyway, some of these fashions started among upper-class Britishers in the home counties of London and caught on. And the way we know that these fashions began in the 1780s is because commentators on language started writing about it. They started making fun, for instance, of poets who would rhyme something like fawn with or farm with darn. They noticed this, and they said, what's going on? Why can't this person speak proper English? But the trend continued, and it spread to from upper-class Londoners, it spread to the prep schools. It spread to Eton and Harrow, and then it spread into London and Cambridge, or Oxford and Cambridge, and it became more or less general that if you were an upper-crust Britisher, this is how you sounded. And it's believed that between about 1780 and 1820, most of these characteristics that we think of as the British accent developed. Now, I'm greatly oversimplifying here, and there have been books written on the subject by linguists. I can for people who are disbelieving about this, I can refer to some. There's a linguist named Linda Muggleston, Muggleston, who's done some writing on this, and others have. And also travelers to the U.S. in the early 19th century made note of the fact that Americans still sounded like the British had sounded before the colonies were established. So this is how we know these things. And there's even a movement in Britain called Original Pronunciation, OP. David Crystal, a linguist, has done work along these lines. David Crystal, spelled C-R-Y-S-T-A-L, so you can look him up. Look up original pronunciation and David Crystal, and you'll find some of the work he's done. Some people have tried to restore Shakespearean pronunciation to what it was in Elizabethan times, and to produce Shakespearean plays in the original accent. And it's really odd because if you hear one of these productions, you hear Shakespeare being done in what sounds like more like an American accent.
Huh. That is so interesting. Jeffrey, thank you so much for asking that question, for bringing that up today. If you have questions for Pat, give us a call, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Here's a question from Veronica in Iowa City. The question is about bring, brought, and take. The announcer at men's basketball games in Iowa City says during every game, if the Hawkeyes score more than 80 points, bring your ticket stub to Herky's locker room for a discount. He should say, take your ticket.
Yeah,
also,
unless he's speaking from Herky's locker room, if I'm saying that correctly. The thing with bring and take is I found that a lot of people I know from the Midwest have no problem with this. They do it. They use bring and take the standard way automatically.
Okay, and explain to us the difference. So
it's a matter of perspective. It's not just which way the goods are traveling. It's the perspective of the speaker. If you're speaking from the receiving end, you want to use bring. If you're not speaking from the actual destination point, then you would use take.
Okay.
So it's not just which way things are moving. It's the point of view of the speaker. Now, my husband is from New York. Like a lot of New Yorkers, he uses bring for everything. He says, I'm going to bring the car to the shop to get fixed.
All right.
It means it's take.
Right. And so, but you're saying many Midwesterners just sort of instinctively...
They instinctively do it.
It the correct way.
Yeah, there's no problem.
Is this one of those areas in language where we're experiencing an evolution?
Well, I don't know about that.
I mean, if literally can mean figuratively, then I would think that bring could mean take.
I'm not so sure that there's an evolution going on with bring and take. I still think that the perspective of the speaker is what's going to determine whether you're talking about if something's going over there, it's being taken. If something's being brought to me, it's being brought, and you use the word bring. You wouldn't say, bring your dog to the vet if it needs a shot, unless you're speaking from the vet's office.
Right.
Unless you're the vet.
Say, bring him in.
Yes, bring him in. You'd say, take your dog to the vet if he needs a vaccination.
How about in past tense? So,
same thing.
Okay.
Took and brought. It's just, yeah, the tense doesn't make any difference.
All right.
I don't know if I've answered the listener's question. But you do hear an awful lot of bouncing around, and it may be that the announcer is from Chicago or something, and he's been influenced by I don't know what, but it seems that most of the time when I get a question about this, it's from somebody who's been hearing speech on the East Coast or in Chicago.
All right. And here's someone to answer our question about cornflakes. Veronica in Dubuque. Hi, Veronica.
Hello.
Hi. Can you settle this for us?
I was in England in 1948, and I lived there until 1971 when I came to the States. And from my earliest days, I remember cornflakes in the Kellogg's box with the corn on the front. It was called cornflakes.
Aha, okay.
However, I do appreciate hearing the background because all my time I lived there, I was not in an agricultural area, but I never heard any grain referred to as corn in my area. So I was interested to hear the background, because I would read books and think, how come there was a corn exchange, in the 1700s when we didn't have corn?
Right.
So
right.
I meant a grain exchange.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, Veronica, thank you so much for settling that. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking with Patricia O'Connor today. She's the author of Woe Is I. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and you can ask your English language questions at 866-780-9100. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My guest today is Patricia O'Connor. She's the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and she's here to answer your questions about the English language, 866-780-9100. We just heard the Tallcorn song. Patricia, can you explain why they say Iowa instead of Iowa?
I was wondering that myself. Iowa? Does anyone really say Iowa?
No, no one.
No.
All right, let's get back to the phones. Nikki's on the line in Jefferson County. Hi, Nikki.
Hi. I have two questions. The first one, I grew up in like Keokuk, Mahaskin, Jefferson counties, but I've heard other people use the word wash with an R in it. Warsh.
Warsh.
Which yes. Drives me.
Makes you want to wash their mouths out with soap, right?
Oh, and I drove my parents crazy. I'd ask Mom, where's the R in wash?
Yeah.
And finally she told me to just shut up.
there's a name for that. In linguistics, it's called the intrusive R. And a lot of people do insert that R in a long A sound like that, wash, warsh. Some people say Washington, too, going to Washington, D.C.
Oh, yes. I've heard that.
Yes. I don't know that there's a particular reason for it. It's a common pronunciation. I don't know if I'd call it a mispronunciation. I always feel comfortable.
Denigration.
Well, I feel uncomfortable saying something's wrong. It's one pronunciation. It's not the standard one, but it is another pronunciation.
So it's kind of like a sub-regional accent?
I don't know that it's regional because it may be all over the country.
Hmm.
I don't know that it's regional.
Okay,
but I always heard it. I heard it a lot when I was growing up in Des Moines. Some people said Warsh. A lot of people said it. And they said Washington.
And washing machine.
Washing machine. Right, right. This needs washed.
Yeah. Drives me crazy.
Yeah.
The other question I had was, I believe the word pleaded mm-hmm. guilty.
Right.
Is that sort of...
It's normal. It's normal. The word
I recall the word pled.
Well, the verb plead has two past tenses. It has pled and it has pleaded. The word sometimes it's a difference between official court terminology and normal English, but there's no correct way. I think in Britain and the U.S. it's different. Some courts say pleaded and some say pled.
All right, Nikki, thank you so much for your call. We've got another corn-related call, and this is one that's come up on the show before. Kippy is on the line in Cedar Falls. Hi, Kippy.
Hi.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, when I was a kid growing up in Tana, Illinois, around Halloween, we used to collect field corn, you know, before that, shell it, and then at night we'd go out and throw corn at people's doors and windows.
Well,
and
yeah, you call it corning their windows.
And then I moved to Paxton, Illinois, and everybody thought I was crazy.
Yeah,
you know, nobody did it. And I never have been able to find out, you know, when I go on the Internet and look for it, all I get is Corning, New York. You know, I can't.
You know, I think that, and maybe Charity will remember this, we did a show once about Halloween words and terminology and traditions. And I think one of them was to corn people's windows.
Right. And this was a caller brought it up. Pat right. and I had never heard of it. And then several other people called. So, Kippy, you are not entirely alone, but apparently it's a pretty small club.
Maybe it was Eastern Iowa and Illinois.
Maybe
where it happened. I don't know. But I never heard of it when I was a kid. It was just toilet paper and eggs.
Right. Right.
It wasn't corn. The corn seems fairly harmless unless you throw it really hard. And it would just, you know, decompose on the ground, I guess. That seems fairly benign. I'd rather have that than eggs or toilet paper.
Right. So does that make you feel less alone, Kippy?
Yes, it does.
All right, good.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks so much for your call. 866-780-9100. Jeff is up next in Ankeny. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
Hi, what's your question?
Well, it's about singular and plural. Watching the World Cup, the broadcasters would talk about a team. Mm-hmm. The American broadcasters would say, for example, Germany is playing well.
Mm-hmm.
And the British broadcasters would say, Germany are playing well.
Right, right. That's because in Britain and the United States, we have different ways of referring to collective nouns that have to do with sports teams. Like they will say, In a soccer game, Manchester are winning. And we would say Manchester is winning. So they refer to a sports team in the plural, even if they aren't saying like the Yankees or the members of Manchester are winning. They would just say Manchester are winning. Similarly, they use plural verbs when they speak of singular collective nouns like the cabinet, the government, the company. They will say the company are planning to do something, or the cabinet are meeting, or the government are planning something. So for collective nouns, they use plural verbs, whereas they use plurals and we use singular. We would say the cabinet is meeting. Where the government is planning to do something.
All right. Does that help you out, Jeff?
Sure. Neither one's right, though, right? I mean, neither one's wrong.
Well, we can think of the British as being wrong, and they can think of us as being wrong. But it's just two different conventions.
Right. I mean, if you used that British convention, if you were writing a paper or just speaking in the United States, people would think you were wrong.
Yeah, you'd probably get a correction. It would get circled in red on your paper. You do one thing in one country and one in another.
All right. Jeff, thanks a lot for your call. Next up, we've got Larry in Coralville. Hi, Larry.
Good morning.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question on the term can't win for losing.
Uh-huh.
How did the word for become into the use on that term?
Well,
I know how to use it, but...
Right. It's an idiomatic expression that means you can't win because you're always losing. We recently wrote a blog item about this. I'm just going to quickly call it up and see if I can explain it better. But it's like I can't win because I'm always losing. Let me see here. There's not anything really deep about this about the expression. It means you can't win if you're losing all the time. It's basically defined as meaning you're unable to make any sort of success or you're persistently losing or being bested in something.
Well, and it doesn't. I guess when we hear it, we know what it means. But
sure.
I think Larry's question is
why
do we say it that way? Because it doesn't. If you didn't already know what it meant, you wouldn't know
says. There's one thing about that. You ask why we use the word for in there. For is a preposition, and in idiomatic English, we use prepositions in all sorts of bizarre ways, like. We sign up for something, we sign off on something, we call up something, we put up our hair, we put down a person if we're complaining about him, or like if we're making a joke about somebody, we send him up. There's no good way of explaining the idiomatic use of prepositions in English. That's all I can say about it.
All right, Larry, I hope that helps. And we have another question about prepositions. This is from Cindy and Ames. I'm seeing and hearing prepositions being used more and more interchangeably. Most recently, I saw one on the State of Iowa website referring to a farmer installing equipment to his farm. Is this part of a long-term trend toward looser preposition rules? And do I need to stop letting it drive me crazy?
Yeah, I that's an unusual case.
So she should still let that drive her crazy.
Yeah, it should drive you crazy. These things have a reason. If something bothers you, there's a reason for it, generally. It may just be that you're not used to it, or it may be that it's outrageously substandard. But at any rate, trust your instincts. If you're curious about something, there's a reason that it made you curious. But usually we say you're making improvements to your farm, or you're installing new equipment on your farm, or you're planning new equipment for your farm. There are certain idiomatic ways of using prepositions, but usually those ways stay more or less the same.
All right, so that was an editing mistake.
I think so. I think so.
All right, Matt in Des Moines is up next. Hi, Matt.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What's your question?
So when I was in the Marine Corps, I heard people from all over the United States, and people from the East Coast would always, if someone wanted to get like a root beer or something, they referred to all of them as a Coke. It didn't matter what kind it was, it was always a Coke.
I think that's from the
West Coast, it was called a pop.
Yeah. Well, the people in the East don't refer to root beer as Coke. It may be that people in the South use Coke for all kinds of carbonated beverages. But people in the East, if they want to use a generic term for a carbonated beverage, they say soda. So they'll say, I'll have a burger and a soda for lunch, or a burger and a Coke if they want to be specific. They wouldn't use pop because pop seems to be peculiarly associated with certain parts of the Midwest and the South. They'll say pop rather than soda.
Now, this has been a debate going on for forever, I think, ever since pop was invented.
They have even done maps of the United States with different, like, pop over here, soda here, Coke there, and whatever.
I wonder if we're becoming more homogeneous on this front, though, because I think about, when kids are growing up and they're watching TV, and most of the time on television, if somebody is drinking this kind of beverage, they will call it a soda. I wonder if pop and Coke are going to get outmoded.
I don't know. I don't see any sign of it. Pop is so widespread. I know the last time I was in Iowa, which was in May, I even saw it on signs. Pop, cold pop inside. I don't see it fading out anytime soon.
So we don't have to even make an effort to hang on to it.
I think it's safe.
All right. Michael's up next in Mechanicsville. Hi, Michael.
Hi.
Hi, what's your question?
I have a question about the word either, E-I-T-H-E-R. Uh-huh. I was taught it was a corollary of or, like either or and neither nor.
Right.
But I hear it often used like it's used in substitute for both or each. Put one on either side. And so my question do I put it, which side do I put it on? And they said, you put it on either side. Well, that means both or what? Do I have a choice?
Right. One use of either is that it means it can be on one side or the other. But you're right. There's an ambiguity in using it like that because you could mean it in two ways. You could mean only one side, but choose which side you want, or it could mean both sides. Put it on both sides. So it can be ambiguous at times. You're right.
So they don't care.
It's not incorrect to use it that way. It's just that you should, people who use it that way should know that there could be an ambiguity. So it might be clearer to say use it on both sides or use it on one side or the other.
All right, Michael, I hope that settles that for you. Steve is on the line in Red Oak. Hi, Steve.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I'm calling today about a word that my grandmother used that I haven't heard really any other place, and it was when we would cut hay and put the bales up in what she called the hay mow, and everywhere else is the hay loft. It's something that I've heard since I was a child, but really
right.
only from her and not many other places. And
right.
I wouldn't even know how to spell mow. If it's M-O-W,
it's M-O-W
or what.
Yeah. Spelled M-O-W, and it's a pretty common word. It just means a place where hay is stored. Or it's often pronounced mow, a hay mow.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
Or it can be mow. But okay. It's a place where hay is stored. I think usually if it's a loft, hay loft, it's elevated. It's up high, I think. I'm just guessing. I don't have the OED open or anything, but I think
enough.
A hay mow can be like a manger, a trough where you put hay that cattle can reach it. And or it could be to store, but I think it's in a lower level. And a loft implies that it's stored up high, like in the roof of a barn or attic or second floor of a barn.
Okay.
I may be wrong. Maybe there are farmers out there who will correct me.
Well, Steve, thank you so much for your call. And I have heard it, but you don't hear it nearly as often.
Not as much.
As loft. And, of course, not as many people are interacting with hay as
you
used to. All right. Final call of the day, Diane from Des Moines. Hi, Diane.
Hi. I just learned that at the age of 60, I've been saying the word across wrong all my life. I said across. Hands across the water with the T at the end. And there is no such thing. I've never spelled it that way, but I've always pronounced it that way, and a lot of people I know do.
Right, yeah, a lot of people do pronounce it that way.
Right, we talked about the intrusive R a little while ago, as in Warsh. You might call that an intrusive T. Yeah, across the street.
And as long as you spell it the right way, I think you're okay, right?
That's the main thing. That's the main thing. But no, that is a common pronunciation. It's not the standard one, but a lot of people do add a T to it.
And it's not one of those that makes my my skin crawl
nah.
at all. there are a
live
few
and
others.
Let live.
Right. All right, Pat, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Patricia O'Connor is the author of Woe Is I and other books about the English language. She blogs at grammarphobia.com, and she joins us every now and then to enlighten us about various parts of the English language. Talk of Iowa is produced by Dennis Reese, Claire Roth, Lindsay Moon, and Emily Woodbury. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.
Where Daddy always worked hard every day. Think it kinda hurt him when I said, Daddy, there's a lot that I don't know.